My castaway this week is Stuart Christie, the anarchist writer and publisher. He was born in the Partick area of Glasgow on July 10th, 1946. He was raised by his grandparents and his grandmother in particular, and what he describes as her selfless acts of Christian charity had an enormous impact on the boy growing up in the tenement buildings of post-war Glasgow, what he has called the sandstone canyons of his childhood. He became involved in the youth wing of the Labour Party while still at school and soon became active in CND and the more radical Committee of 100. At the age of 16, coming out of Glasgow Central Library, he chanced across a meeting of the Glasgow Anarchist Federation and realised that it was anarchism that best represented his worldview. Within 2 years, he was involved in a plot to assassinate General Franco, at the behest of a secret organisation made up of people from the exiled Spanish anarchist movement. And it was as part of this plot that he was arrested in Madrid, having carried a rucksack of explosives from Paris to be used to blow General Franco up. He was found guilty of banditry and terrorism and was sentenced to 20 years in a Spanish jail. We'll talk about Spain a little later, but first, Stuart, do you think it's fair to say your grandmother's example laid the foundations for the life you have led since?
Well, I think so. I mean, my grandmother was probably the most important influence, moral influence in my life. I mean, she provided the template, as it were, for the character, the person I eventually became.
And your grandfather was there for the first part of your life, wasn't he?
He was. My grandfather died in 1954. He was also a very important part of my life. Although my grandmother, she was more influential, my grandfather was there in the background. But he was never the sort of strict grandfather that you would, that he was, say, with my mother. And he was, of course, he came from a military background. And he'd been in the British Army since the age of 14 and a half. He gave the wrong age and went off to fight in India and Afghanistan. And he was, of course, very much a disciplinarian, certainly with the troops, you know. He was also there, and he provided a different type of example in my growing up.
Tell me about your first choice of music.
Yeah, my first choice of music would be Goodbye Dolly Gray by a Canadian singer called Harry McDonough. And the reason for this is my earliest musical recollections are of me sitting on my grandpa's knees in the kitchen, listening to the big walnut valve radio and him singing to me. But I particularly remember this Boer War song by Harry McDonough. It was a popular music hall song, and I have warm memories of him, being taken by my granny and my grandpa to the old Metropole Theatre in Stockwell Street in Glasgow. Anyway, this song reminds me of him and about growing up in the Glasgow of the late 1940s and the early 1950s.
I have come to say goodbye, Dolly Gray. It's no use to ask me why, Dolly Gray. There's a murmur in the air, you can hear it everywhere. It is time to do and dare, Dolly Gray. Don't you hear the tramp of feet, Dolly Gray? Sounding through the village street, Dolly Gray. Is the tramp of soldiers true in their uniforms of blue? I must say goodbye to you, Dolly Gray. Goodbye, Dolly, I must leave you, though it breaks my heart to go. Something tells me I am needed at the front to fight the foe. See the boys in blue are marching, and I can no longer stay. Calling, goodbye, Dolly Gray. Hear the rolling of the drums, Dolly Gray. Back from war, the regiment comes, Dolly Gray. On your lovely face so fair, I can see a look of care, for your soldier boy's not there.
That was Goodbye Dolly Grey by Harry McDonnell. Could you describe a little what the Glasgow of your youth was like and how you think it almost encouraged people to take a political position? I'm thinking particularly of the sectarian divisions that existed and still exist in the city today.
Now, I wouldn't say it forced me to take a political position. I mean, it was a judgmental thing. You know, you're out, you see injustice. I think that's probably the most important element in radicalisation, where you actually see injustices, see things that are wrong, you see poverty. And you see, it was very much a class-based society where, for example, where I lived in Glasgow, the people at the bottom of the hill, Highland Street, were the poorest, mostly Catholic working-class people, whereas the people at the very top of Highland Street, up in Woody, Kelvin Side, they were the upper class. I mean, the amazing thing I found after my book was published, Granny Made Me an Anarchist, was the number of people I came across, who contemporaries who lived through the same period and who just didn't relate to what was happening to the Glasgow that I described. So obviously my Glasgow isn't the same Glasgow as lots of other people.
And internationally, events were unfolding that shaped your view of the world.
Probably the pivotal one would be the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, when actually everyone during that week in, I think it was October, November, I can't remember now, where everyone thought that was it, that the world was about to end. And it was a real sort of heart-stopping moment, you know, where you're faced with the reality of that you and the rest of humanity stand a good chance of being wiped out and you have no say in the matter. And it's a result of a decision by so-called state. But then the other big thing, I suppose, was the Cuban Revolution, the possibility of actually overthrowing unjust societies and dictators. I mean, that was one of the big turning points of the 50s, which actually showed that states could be overthrown, unjust states could be overthrown.
Tell me about your next choice of music.
Next choice of music would be Dart Lough Nagar by Callum Kennedy. He had a truly magnificent voice, and he was so famous in Scotland that in 1963, when the newspaper headlines announced that Kennedy had been shot, a lot of folk actually thought it was Callum Kennedy and not the American president. It's a beautiful song about a beautiful place, and I just often wonder what Pavarotti would have made of it.
That's Dark Lough Nagar, sung by Callum Kennedy. And so I suppose we should talk about Spain now. You have described Spain as being a moral touchstone for when you were growing up. Could you tell us a little about that?
Well, the earliest, you know, Spain was always there in the background, but when I moved to Blantyre, which is a mining village in the outskirts of Glasgow, in 1960-61, I actually came into contact with people that Ben had fought in the international brigades, and moved in. I mean, it was a very important influence in the mining community, because they were still, every Saturday night in the miners' welfare, there would be fights between communists and anarchists and Trotskyists outside the miners' welfare, basically replaying the battles of May 1937 in Barcelona, when effectively, although I wasn't fully aware of this at the time, the Communist Party was seen to have betrayed the whole revolutionary process, which had launched in response to the military uprising in 1936. So that was the point at which I became aware of the relevance and the importance of the Spanish Civil War in everyday life. It was still an important subject that people would fight over.
And how did you find yourself with a rucksack of explosives in Madrid at the tender age of 18?
I became involved with the Spanish exile movement in London. And through them I met members of the clandestine planning organisation of the CNT and the Field Anarchist Youth Movement. And then one thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was in Paris with plastic explosive and detonators and so on, heading for Spain. I was arrested in Madrid because the Spanish secret police were waiting for me. There had been some collaboration with between Scotland Yard and the Spanish police, but also I was naive in as much as I didn't understand the extent to which the exile movement had been infiltrated by agents and by confidential agents and by informers.
You were sentenced to 20 years in prison. I wonder if you can recall your sentencing and what was going through your mind as you faced the prospect of spending so much time in jail.
Well, the whole thing was very unreal. You know, basically you're sitting there in front of, which is like an Austro-Hungarian opera, you know, men with epaulettes and swords and trooping in, sitting on a dais a red-faced prosecutor gesticulating wildly and pointing in my direction. In fact, I didn't speak Spanish. I had no idea what was going on. But I just saw this man, say, wildly gesticulating and shouting and going red in the face and pointing at me. And I actually turned and looked behind me to see who was pointing at, but it was me. And then I was taken back to prison, and two or three days later, they slipped a note. This was 1964. A note was slipped under my door after lights out, which I was able to read. And it said, date of release, 1984, which was a very Orwellian sort of date, you know, which was so far in the future it was fiction, you know.
Yes, I can imagine. And what was prison life like? How did you pass your time?
I mean, it's a great university, prison. And the way I looked upon it, you know, because I had no idea when I was getting out. I mean, I knew I was supposed to be getting out in 1984, but I also knew that I wasn't going to spend 20 years in jail because of the political pressures on the regime. But it could have been anything from 5 to 10 years. It was just completely outside my control. But, you know, you meet people, you discuss, you test your ideas against other people and you formulate your own.
You were eventually released after serving just 3 years of your sentence. How did that come about?
Well, the political situation in Spain at the time was Franco was desperate to join the EC, and so there was that pressure on them that they had to be, because I was a sort of a boil in Franco's body politic. Because there were demonstrations taking place in support of my, you know, people demanding my freedom all over the world, from the States and Europe. People like Jean-Paul Sartre were signing petitions and so on. So that was a constant, point of irritation for them. And so there was that. There was Gibraltar. There was the growth of tourism, because Spain was highly dependent on tourism for its revenue. And there was the continuing anti-tourist campaign by the anarchist youth movement. But there was also, more importantly, was the action by the 1st of May group, where they carried out a series of machine gunnings in London and in New York. And they also kidnapped one of the Spanish diplomat in London. So the whole thing seemed to be building up. And the culmination was, I was told by the British embassy that I had to write to my mother and ask her to prepare a letter, to write a letter to General Franco asking for a pardon. So the understanding was that it would be looked upon kindly. And so she wrote requesting a pardon from Franco, and it was granted.
Can you tell us about your third piece of music?
The third piece of music is Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival. In 68, the bubble burst for a lot of people, and with it went that sense of hope, which to me characterised the decade. A lot of activists felt that they had given all that they could, and to no apparent effect. And there was nothing further that they had to offer without endangering their careers, their freedom, and possibly their lives. So they refocused and they narrowed their political horizons away from the prospect of radical change towards a politics which was based on expediency and self-interest rather than fundamental principles. And it was really a bad moon rising.
That was Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival. So you returned to England in the late 1960s. How was it different to the place you'd left 3 years before?
Well, it's completely different. I mean, I left, it was like that scene in The Wizard of Oz, you know, where the world turned from grey to black, you know, from grey to full colour, you know. So I can always remember coming back down from driving in from Heathrow Airport and saw these beautiful girls with short skirts and bright colours, and it was extraordinary, you know. It really was like that Wizard of Oz moment, you know.
And did you immediately re-immerse yourself in the radical left?
Oh, absolutely, more so, because it was to do with, you know, when you come out of prison, you leave all those people behind, and these, you know, particularly with regard to Spain, where there was no one concerned with the rights of the political prisoners. The only people who got support in the prisons were Jehovah's Witnesses. There was no one actually doing anything on behalf of the anarchists or the socialists or the Trotskyists. Communist Party got prisoners, they got support from within the party. So I felt that, I had to do some sort of organisation to focus and channel support for these prisoners who'd been forgotten.
This was also the period of, first of all, the Situationists and later the Angry Brigade. Could you talk about what your attitude was to these two groups?
Well, with relation to the Situationists, I knew one or two of them who were based around the Notting Hill area. One in particular, John Greville, was a good friend of mine. But I could never actually take them seriously, you know. I thought they were... although, subsequently, I've come to, I greatly admire their analysis of the situation then. But at the time, I was very dismissive of them. But they were great... very theatrical and colourful people and imaginative, great imagination. One of the best actions at the time was the liberation of Power Square, which was actually led by John Greville in a monkey suit or a gorilla suit. They tore down the, and that was something that none of the other groups would have even considered doing.
And later the Angry Brigade.
Well, the I suppose with the Angry Brigade, it happened in that period immediately after 68, where it became, obviously it became, the whole point of protest wasn't getting anywhere. And the only way that you could add some sort of drama to the situation was by direct actions of a more sort of forceful and anti-parliamentary kind. And the Angry Brigade emerged in that political context, where other methods were simply, not getting anywhere.
Can you tell us about your next record?
My next record is Butterfly Mornings by Jason Robards and Stella Stevens. And this is, it comes from the film, great film by Sam Peckinpah in 1970, The Ballad of Cable Hog. I saw it just before I was arrested in connection with the so-called Angry Brigade case. And in it, Robards plays the part of a cantankerous old desert hobo who's left to die without water in the desert by his two mates. Hogue, he doesn't die, but instead he discovers water and sets up a profitable business for the stage line. And after several years, his two former friends come along and he takes his well-deserved revenge on them for leaving him to die.
Butterfly mornings, butterfly mornings, and wildflower afternoons. Catch me there, gonna get me there. If I have to climb all the mountains on the moon, I'll be in butterfly mornings, butterfly mornings and wildflower afternoons. On the wings of a butterfly, I woke to my morning. On the beams of a sunflower, on the day I was born in. On the petals of a wildflower, with the sun at high noon, I went walking in butterfly mornings and wildflower afternoons.
You can I'll catch find me you in a cantaloupe, down there sitting on a seed. Gonna trace your footsteps underneath the weeds. Gonna string you up some dandelions. You're gonna wear them as beads. You'll I'll be dancing with lace wings and dimples on a big city sign that reads. Butterfly mornings, butterfly mornings, butterfly mornings, and wildflowers.
That was Butterfly Mornings, sung by Jason Robards and Stella Stevens. Films like Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life and television programmes like The Lone Ranger and Bilko influenced you a lot. Can you talk about what you took from them?
Well, I think mostly the films that I grew up with were films which I found inspiring, which, you know, where people challenge injustice, and it's a sort of, I suppose it's a Panglossian type world where everything turns out well. At least that you aim for that. You aim for that end, ultimately.
Tell me about your next piece of music.
Next piece of music is "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have" by Marlene Dietrich. This is really a bit of light relief, because in August 1971, when the first six of us were arrested in Amherst Road in Stoke Newington and charged with basically being the I Brigade, we were taken in for interrogation to the so-called Bomb Squad headquarters in Albany Street Police Station, which is then designated as the top security police station in London. And they kept us there from the Saturday, well, me from the Saturday, they'd arrested the others on the Friday night, through to the Monday morning, when we were then taken before a magistrate and remanded in custody in Brixton Prison. But while we were in our separate cells that Sunday night, the then Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir John Waldron, whose home had been bombed by the Angry Brigade, anyway, he came to give, basically to gloat over us and gloat, you know, sort of give us the once over through the spy hole in the door. But anyway, as he was walking along the corridor with all of the Scotland Yard and Home Office bigwigs, we all sort of burst into song, mainly to keep our spirits up and show a bit of defiance. And the first song was "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have," as sung by Marlene Dietrich in Destry Rides Again. It makes me smile every time I think about it.
See what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I'm having the same. Go see what the boys in the back room will have, and give them the poison they name. And when I die, don't spend my money on flowers and my picture in a frame. Just see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I cried, and tell them I died of the same. And when I die, don't buy a casket of silver with the candles all aflame. Just see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I cried, and tell them I died of the same. I die, don't pay the preacher for speaking of my glory and my fame. Just see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I cried.
That's "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have" by Marlene Dietrich. The Angry Brigade targeted property, not people, and nobody was killed as a result of their actions. As someone involved in an attempt to kill General Franco, how did you view this wish to avoid casualties?
Well, in the case of Franco, he had to die. I mean, he was the ultimate obstacle to, apart from, you know, the number of people that whose deaths he was responsible for. You know, he was responsible for killing more Spaniards than Hitler killed German Jews. You're talking about, upwards of well over a million people. But, I mean, that happened previously. But, as I say, the only obstacle to a transition to a more free society, a more democratic society, was Franco, because he had, you know, he hadn't appointed any successors. There were competing political groups around him, the Falange, the army, the Catholic Church, all of them waiting to step in, take over once he'd gone. So there was no other option. Franco had to die.
Tell me about your next record.
My next record is At the Chocolate Bon Bon Ball by Leon Redbone. He's got such a gentle, kind and warm voice coupled with effortless delivery, and you can't help but smile and feel warm inside. And At the Chocolate Bon Bon Ball, which is a great piece of surrealist whimsy, is just one among many of my favourite Leon Redbone recordings.
At 12 o'clock last night, I gently dimmed my light. Then I fell into a slumber. I had a dream so rare, I know you'll declare it was a marvelous wonder. Chocolate bonbons gave a ball for the candies, one and all. Dancing at the chocolate bonbon ball, prancing round that sugar-coated hall, Adam with the blackjack in his hand led the band. Some young fellow called Marshmallow played the mean and wicked cello. Randy drops the world around us showered when they opened up those almond bars, and the lollipop met Miss Lemon Drop at the chocolate bonbon ball. Chocolate-coated butts and those assorted nuts made love to old-fashioned taffy, a little jelly bean, and Mr. Walnut Cream acted as though they were daffy. Fast asleep, I'd love to fall just a dream about that ball. Dancing at that chocolate bonbon ball, prancing round that sugar-coated hall, goodness, how that liquorated gum beat the drum. Cupid's little peanut brittle played the jazz upon her fiddle when the break of day began to beat. Old Rock Candy rocked them all to sleep. Mrs. Juicy.
That's Leon Redbone singing At the Chocolate Bon Bon Ball. After the Angry Brigade trial, you moved out of London, first to Huddersfield and then to Orkney. How did that come about?
Well, basically, after London, after the Angry Brigade trial, I was visited by a special branch officer who, you know, who said, really, you should get out of London because there are people in the force who will stop at nothing to make sure that you go to prison. And so, discretion being the better part of valour, I decided to move up to Huddersfield and hopefully... apart from that, it was time to move on, do something different. And so we moved to Huddersfield, to the little village of Hornley. So it was a very, very interesting period. And we set up an anarchist group in Huddersfield, which became quite active. And obviously we came to the attention of the Huddersfield police and the special branch. And it became obvious that it was time for me to move on again. And one thing led to another, and we came across, somebody introduced us to a couple of teachers who had a house for sale up in Orkney, in the island of Orkney, up in off the north coast of Scotland. And so we decided to move up there. Fortunately, we did, because shortly after we moved, there was a whole series of raids and arrests, and that ended in what became known as the Persons Unknown case at the end of the 70s.
Can you talk about how you became involved in the Persons Unknown case?
Not really, no.
Can you tell us about your next piece of music?
Next piece of music is Rio by Michael Naismith. Again, this is going back to in 76 when things were getting hot for us in Hornley. the former Luddite stronghold, we decided to move to the Northern Isles. So it was a bit of an imaginative leap, as you can imagine, as it wasn't easy to get from Huddersfield to Orkney, logistically. But it was an adventure, and the Orkneys appealed to me because I think it's something to do with the fact that my dad, who was a deep-sea fisherman, had spoken about Orcadians quite often. He'd spoken about Orkney, and he'd taken shelter, his boat, you know, with his boat, he'd taken shelter there occasionally. Anyway, the bottom line was that we went to live in the island of Sandy in the Northern Isles, and we remained there for 7 years. Mostly it was great, and it was a beautiful island, but it was a difficult place to get both to and from. And the stormy weather in winter and the summer haars, the sea fogs, meant that you could be cut off from the outside world for weeks on end. So travel could be very, very frustrating, even at the best of times. And as they say in Orkney, God laughs at those who make travel plans.
I'm hearing the light from the window. I'm seeing the sound of the sea. My feet have come loose from their moorings. I'm feeling quite wonderfully free. And I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight. But I probably won't fly down to Rio, but then again, I just... There's wings to the thought behind fancy. There's wings to the thought behind play. And dancing to rhythms of laughter makes laughter the rhythm of rain. So I think I will travel to Rio, using the music for flight. There's nothing I know of in Rio, but it's something to do with the night. It's only a whimsical notion to fly down to Rio tonight.
That's Rio by Michael Nesmith. You have talked about how when people are forced to act clandestinely, they quickly lose the sight of the idealism they once had because they are forced towards criminality by necessity, underground groups robbing banks to fund their cause, that sort of thing. Would you describe yourself as an idealist?
Yes, yeah. An optimist.
Have you ever felt in danger of losing your ideals?
Well, there's always tension between, you know, the way you should act and the way you're you have to act. I mean, there's a sort of... your life is a barometer where the sort of top is the ideal which you should aspire to, aim towards, the star that you should follow, as it were. But quite often, you know, you have to compromise. And that's the unfortunate thing, especially with age, because when you're younger, you know, people tend not to compromise. And far more, younger people tend to be more idealistic, you know, which is why most... you know, in your youth, more people, you get more radicals among young people.
You've been promoting anarchism for over 45 years now. Do you ever feel like giving up?
No, you need some... Everyone needs some sort of moral ideal. You need that. I mean, some people find it in their... people need things to believe in. And for me, that is the... you know, it's the ideal way for people to live their life. It's the ideal aim. It may never be achievable, but you have to aspire towards the best.
Tell me about your final piece of music.
The final choice of music would be Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think by Guy Lombard. And I think it's to do with having spent a fair amount of time in solitary and on my own in top security prisons in Spain and Britain. But, I mean, I'm more than happy with my own company, so life in a desert island wouldn't really be a problem. But to prevent me slipping into maudlin and self-pitying moods, I need to avoid, avoid morose sentimentality.
You work and work for years and years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
You're gonna take that ocean trip, no matter come what may. You've got your reservations made, but you just can't get away. Next year for sure you'll see the world, you'll really get around. But how far can you travel when you're 6 feet underground? Your heart of hearts, your dream of dreams, your ravishing brunette. She's left you and she's now become somebody else's pet. Lay down that gun, don't try, my friend, to reach the great beyond. You'll have more fun by reaching for a redhead or a blonde.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
You never go to nightclubs and you just don't care to dance. You don't have time for silly things like moonlight and romance. You only think of...
Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think by Guy Lombardo. Now, we give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You can take one other book. What would it be?
The one other book I'd take would be the Parahandi Omnibus, which is a collection of short stories by a Glasgow writer by the name of Neil Munro, also known as Hugh Fowlis. And these are the stories of a puffer called The Vital Spark. In fact, they made a famous television series. Well, they made a couple of television series about the Vital Spark. And it's just a very witty, light-hearted account of life in the Highlands and Islands in Glasgow of the early 1900s.
And Stuart, if a wave should come and wash everything away and you could save just one record, which would that be?
I'd take Chocolate Bon Bon Ball.
And I can let you have one luxury.
I would take... take an iMac.
Well, Stuart Christie, thank you for sharing your Dissident Island discs.